This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, some just absolutely amazing things in the news today. This meltdown in Iran, or in Iraq, this concerns me tremendously. And McCain's perspective on this concerns me, frankly, even more. First of all, this from the Times Online. The price of crude oil surged this morning after saboteurs bombed one of Iraq's. Jeez. Now John McCain's got me doing it, right? Bombed one of Iraq's main oil pipelines in what was feared to be a backlash attack by powerful Shia Muslim militias. This is the attack is being seen as an act of retaliation for the government's campaign to crack down on the Shia private armies, many of them Iranian-backed, which have exerted a powerful and violent influence over the south and center of Iraq. So basically what you have here is Sadr's Shia army, is now going after the Shia-owned, Shia-dominated, Shia-controlled government of Iraq. And which has been making perfunctory gestures towards bringing in the Sunnis with this new anti-debathification law, which actually turns out could actually keep Sunnis out of the government. The Sunnis are feeling very disenfranchised. So we stepped in because the Sunnis were killing our guys. And we said, we'll take 60, 70, 80,000, maybe as many as 100,000 Sunnis, and we'll pay them 10 bucks a week. If they form these, there's a bunch of different names for them, Freedom and Daylight and Daybreak and whatnot, militias, these new Sunni militias that will not attack Americans, but will just kind of keep the streets clean and keep the Al-Qaeda guys out of the Sunni neighborhoods, keep the extremists out of the Sunni. So they've been taking our money, but our money's been routed through the government in Iraq, and the government in Iraq is now not all that enthusiastic about paying the Sunni militias anymore, and so now they're not getting paid, and so they're starting to shoot at us. And now you've got the Shia government and the Shia militias fighting with each other, and they just blew up this pipeline overnight, and one of the major, Basra is a major oil port in the south, or near to a port city. And I'm just very concerned that if this thing melts down really fast in a really big way, we're going to have soldiers and contractors caught in a crossfire that they may not be able to get out of. And you're going to have, 20, 30 million civilians who are not of military age and, who won't participate in the conflict, but will be absolute right in the crosshair victims. So John McCain yesterday gave this speech in which he was talking about these autocratic regimes. And this is the interesting thing about this is there are parts of this analysis with which I agree, and there are parts of this analysis that are just, let's go through it, because this frankly really concerns me. This is neocon 101. This is Strauss 101. This is Bill Kristol 101. This is the Dick Cheney Project for a New American Century. This is their core organizing principle. And what's so insidious about it is that there is a strong element of truth to it. But the therefore that they draw out of that truth is where it melts down and goes crazy. So here's from John McCain's talk yesterday.
For decades in the greater Middle East, we had a strategy of relying on autocrats to provide order and stability. We relied on the Shah of Iran and autocratic rulers of Egypt, the generals of Pakistan, the Saudi royal family, and even for a time, on Saddam Hussein.
See, now this is the theory that was put forth, or the observation that was put forth by people like, I believe it was Samuel Huntington, and there was a variety of neoconservative writers and philosophers and whatnot, who were writing books in the 80s, well, throughout the late 70s, the 70s, the 80s, into the 90s, suggesting that our foreign policy, saying basically the same thing that progressives had been saying for a century, you know, since we were running banana republics in the late 1900s or in the mid-1900s in Central America, that essentially economic imperialism and the propping up of dictators overseas is not a good idea. Ultimately, it's not in our best interest, even though if over the short term, it's in the interest of some of our economic elites. In this case, in the Middle East, this is all in the interest of ExxonMobil and Chevron and the other economic elites, Halliburton, associated with the oil industry. So McCain continues.
In the late 1970s, that strategy began to unravel. The Shah was overthrown by the radical Islamic revolution that now rules in Tehran. The ensuing ferment in the Muslim world produced increasing instability. The autocrats clamped down with ever greater repression.
And again, he's right. And they did it in a large part at our behest because we saw our economic interests. We funded the Shah of Iran. We overthrew a democratically elected government in Iran to replace them with the Shah of Iran. We helped overthrow a democratically elected government in Iraq. In other words, we took apart democracies to install autocracies because it was in our economic interest, because in both cases, in Iran and Iraq, those governments, those democratic elected governments had moved to nationalize their own oil. So McCain is giving kind of half the history, you know, as if it had always been autocratic. But nonetheless, it's a relatively accurate snapshot of the recent past.
While also surreptitiously aiding Islamic radicalism abroad in the hopes that they would not become its victims.
Now, this is what he's talking about here. And again, the analysis, you know, in a large part is accurate, is, for example, that we were funding Osama bin Laden and the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in their battle against the Soviet Union. And it helped bankrupt the Soviet Union. You know, the whole Charlie Wilson's war scenario, the movie was very imperfect, but there is a large grain of truth to that, that we were funding this and that we were supporting the Saudis, who had made a deal with the devil, with the Wahhabists, and they were then exporting these radical and virulent strains of Islam.
It was a toxic and explosive mixture. The oppression of the autocrats blended with the radical Islamist dogmatic theology to produce a perfect storm of intolerance and hatred.
See, and again, McCain's speechwriter, you know, obviously this isn't the way John McCain talks, you know, but his speechwriter did a really good job with this thing in defining this. And frankly, and not, you know, the irony is if you want to place blame for this, you can go back to a series of administrations. Frankly, there are Democratic as well as Republican administrations. But Reagan was one of the biggest boosters of this kind of a worldview. You know, one of the absolute biggest boosters of the let's support the tyrants. You know, the whole Iran-Contra thing. Let's overthrow, you know, in Nicaragua. Ortega. Let's, you know, he was one of the absolute biggest boosters of the, and you go back to the Nixon, Eisenhower-Nixon administration, and Nixon was in charge of the Cuba division of that. And, you know, Castro took over in 58 or 59 while Nixon was vice president, and because we were supporting Batista, and the people were like, you know, we hate this. So people will rise up against autocrats, and they'll say enough already. So McCain continues.
We can no longer delude ourselves that relying on those outdated autocracies is the safest bet.
Now, this is where it gets dangerous. So now he's saying, all right, we've been relying on these tyrants. Now, he, as I said, he conveniently overlooks the fact that in many cases we put these tyrants in place. He does acknowledge that we have supported them. We've been relying on these tyrants. And again, he doesn't mention that the reason why is to support our economic interests, by and large, in the region. But he says we can no longer rely on these autocrats. Okay. If we can't rely on the autocrats, then what do we need? Well, the neoconservative worldview says what you need is democracy, which sounds just great. It sounds great. I mean, it seems to make perfect sense, right? We need democracy in the Middle East.
They no longer provide lasting stability, only the illusion of it. We must not act rashly or demand change overnight.
Now, that's the problem. See, he says we must not act rashly or demand change overnight, yet that's exactly what his policies are prescribing. That's exactly what the Bush Doctrine is. Invade Iraq, regime change. Support, you know, support the MEC, the terrorists in Iran, which we're doing aggressively. Prepare for a regime change. Prepare to bomb Iran. Prepare, you know, overthrow these governments. Destabilize these governments. And the consequences of that are every bit as horrific as the consequences of initially installing these autocrats, which caused the people to say, wait a minute, we don't want the autocrat. Who are we going to rally around? And the only thing left is the church, basically, the mosque, because that's the only institution that's intact in society. And so the crazies in the mosque end up in control in the streets. Bad formula. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Oh, everyone.
There. See, here's where the neoconservative philosophy becomes really, really toxic and really dangerous. It, on the one hand, correctly suggests, and this is why it's neoconservative rather than conservative, correctly suggests that democracy is the natural state of humans. True conservatives don't believe that. They believe that kingdom and hierarchy is the natural state of humans. Neoconservatives believe democracy is the natural state of humans. It incorrectly assumes that that democracy will exist regardless of the circumstances of those humans. And the fact of the matter is that when people feel that the basic human needs identified by Abraham Maslow as hierarchy of human needs, safety, security, when these basic human needs are not fulfilled, they cannot exist in a state of democracy. This is the problem. This is my assertion. See, the neoconservatives are saying, oh, yeah, you know, if you simply bomb them back into the Stone Age, they will rebuild it as a democracy. No, that's not how it works, as we're seeing in Iraq. That's not how, as we've seen all around the world, you know, over 200 years, over thousands of years, arguably. If you bomb them back to the Stone Age, what will happen is you're going to have clawing and scratching and scraping, and it's really a Thomas Hobbes world, because people are below that threshold of Maslow's. They're below that need for safety and security. They're insecure and they're unsafe and they know it. They're hungry. This is what Franklin Roosevelt said. He said, a necessitous man is not a free man. In other words, if you don't know where your next meal is coming from, if you don't know if you're going to continue to be employed, if you don't know that you have health care available to you, you are not free. And if you're not free, you can't participate in a democracy. And so, yes, the natural state of humans is democratic, small d. But no, you can't simply go into a government, kick over the beehive and say, okay, it's going to be self-organizing. But that's the philosophy the neocons have. And in fact, here's McCain, again, directly addressing that from his speech yesterday.
Aye. But neither can we pretend the status quo is sustainable, stable, or in our interests. Change is occurring whether we want it to or not. The only question for us is, whether we shape this change in ways that benefit humanity or let our enemies seize it for their hateful purposes.
See, and this is basically code for the world is changing, and it is. And are we going to force that change in a way that is going to be beneficial to the United States or not? Now, I believe that we should participate in that change in a way that's beneficial to the United States, and so does John McCain. And here's where I, as a liberal, and liberal in the sense of the Enlightenment liberal, of John Locke liberal, of Thomas Jefferson liberal, of James Madison liberal, of George Washington liberal, of Abraham Lincoln liberal, of Franklin Roosevelt liberal. This is where I, as a Jack Kennedy liberal, this is where I, as a liberal, differ from the neoconservatives, the Ronald Reagan neoconservatives, the Dick Cheney neoconservatives. This is where I differ from them. They suggest that the way to bring about democracy is at the barrel of a gun. You force it on people. I submit to you that the way to bring about democracy is to raise the living standard of people until they're above that threshold until they know that they are safe and secure. This is what we did after World War II. This is what we did in Japan. This is what we did in Germany. This is what we helped the rest of Europe do. You rebuild the country. You rebuild the infrastructure. You do all those things that conservatives and neoconservatives are absolutely opposed to because they believe in this mythology of the so-called free market. They think it just throw it open to corporate forces around the world and every problem will be solved. It's a fallacy. If we want to shape the events in the Middle East, the way to do it is not by increasingly arming both sides. The way to do it is not by taking sides and overthrowing governments that we consider autocratic, even those that are our allies. I mean, McCain comes right up to the edge here of saying that we should help overthrow the governments of Egypt and Saudi Arabia. You do that, you're going to have something that's going to make the Taliban look like a picnic. It gets back to the question of why did Hamas win in Gaza? Why is Hezbollah tolerated in southern Lebanon? It's not because of some kind of shared hatred of Israel. That's really a secondary or even a tertiary factor. Israel is the bugbear. They're using that as the excuse. The bottom line is that these terrorist organizations, from our point of view, And rightfully so, certainly from the point of the view of the Israelis. These terrorist organizations are building hospitals, they're building schools, and they're feeding people, and they're providing employment to people. The employment may not be the kind of employment that we think is a good thing. They're forming militias and things like that. That's what Sadr is doing. It's what Sadr is doing right now in Sadr City in Baghdad. It's what he's doing in Basra. He is feeding people. He's providing them with health care. He's providing them with a basic social safety net. He's providing them with education, with these religious schools. And he is meeting their basic safety and security needs. And so when the whack jobs, when the crazies meet the basic safety and security needs of the people migrate to the crazies. It should be us who's providing the basic safety and security of the people. Instead, what we're doing is destroying it. Look at Iraq right now. Iraq is devastated as a consequence of neoconservative philosophies. And now John McCain wants to take that neoconservative philosophy and export it to more and more countries in the region. This is a prescription for hell. This is a prescription to bring about that Armageddon that Hagee and some of McCain's most virulent and toxic supporters are so fond of. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
8663023 2270. Tom Hartman here back with you. And boy, the piggies are out!
It's 291 billion pounds, Dr. Calculus.
Well, let me see. That would be 145 million and a half tons of the
refuse.
Yeah, refuse. Yes. Per every day, and by the year, let me figure, over 53 million tons of
manure?
Manure, yeah. By comparison, the pyramid of the pharaoh Cheops weighs about 690 million tons, which means that every 4 and 3, you've got a pile of this,
excrement.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the bigger piggies and the starched white shirts you have to worry about. Jeff Manning writing in the Oregonian today. Our state, you know, our local newspaper here, has obtained a memo from J.P. Morgan Chase. This is an internal memo from J.P. Morgan Chase titled Zippy Cheats and Tricks. Well, here, I'll just read you the first two paragraphs of by Jeff Manning in today's Oregonian. A newly surfaced memo from banking giant J.P. Morgan Chase provides a rare glimpse into the mentality that fueled the mortgage crisis. The memo's title says it all. Zippy Cheats and Tricks. It is a primer on how to get risky mortgage loans approved by Zippy, Chase's in-house automated loan underwriting system. The secret to approval? Inflate the borrower's income or otherwise falsify their loan application. And, gee, we wonder about the wonders of unregulated capitalism and, you know, laissez-faire capitalism. Not to trash capitalism in and of itself, but laissez-faire capitalism, unregulated capitalism. It's crazy. Henry in Pennsylvania, 866-303-2270, by the way, our number, tomhartman.com if you want to drop in, and airamerica.com for our blogs and our live chat room. Hey, Henry, what's up?
Oh, and I tell you what, you bring up a lot of good points today, but I just want to say it like this. I understand what you're talking about as a country. We're responsible to help Iraq build hospitals, schools, help create jobs, you know, put power and, you know, basic infrastructure back in that country. But my problem is this. We got a president, and not just him, his whole crony staff to go along with it. We can't even get them to take care of things here, like money for our school systems, to stop corporations taking jobs overseas, to deal with the problems of healthcare system and prescription drug costs and things of that nature. They put Band-Aids on big holes, but the thing is, it's still bleeding. And my thing is, if we can't take care of our home first, how are we going to take care of somebody else?
Yeah, very well said, Henry. Very well said. And the reality is that just like at home, these guys don't believe that social programs, don't believe that helping people get their bootstraps that they can pull themselves up by, they don't believe that that is a legitimate function of government. So they're not providing that as a legitimate function of government in Iraq. They're not doing it here in the United States. I would argue that for probably what we spend in 1 week in Iraq, if we simply gave that money to Iraqis to spend in Iraqi dinars, in local currency, to hire local people. I mean, we're able to hire Sunnis for $10 a week not to kill us. That's what a salary is there. And we're paying Halliburton $500,000 a year per person that they're putting into the country to put Americans in there. And the people in Iraq are looking around going, oh, you know, these Americans are making $500,000, or they're making $100,000. Halliburton's making $500,000, and you got Iraqis who would, you know, the average income in Iraq was $500 a year before we invaded. We could have helped them rebuild that country for nothing compared to what we've spent. And you're absolutely right; we need to be rebuilding this country as well. It has to be step one. Tom in Minneapolis. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Tom. Earlier you were talking about, and I disagree with you, but I just want to pick your brain a little bit. You said that a true conservative doesn't believe in democracy, but rather kingdom and hierarchy, you know, the natural order of humans.
Right. I mean, read Russell Kirk's book, read Edmund Burke's writings.
I agree with you on that. But yeah. Then you said the neoconservatives, they do believe in democracy, but they actually just misunderstand it. But I think actually it's just that word democracy they like to throw around, but they're thinking capitalism. When they use the word democracy, they're not thinking like you and me as liberals. They use the word freedom to mean laissez-faire capitalism. When you and I say freedom, we're thinking about democracy.
Yeah, to a large extent, you're right. Although when you read some of the early writings, I actually quoted some of them in What Would Jefferson Do? Some of the studies that are done, you know, this whole study that was done at the University of California, I believe it was, back about 6-8 years ago, that showed that no two democracies had ever attacked each other.
Right.
And, I mean, that came out of the neoconservatives and their promotion of the idea that if people have a say in whether or not there's war or peace, they'll always choose peace. And there's some truth to that. The problem is, you're absolutely right. Number one, they don't understand what democracy means. They don't understand actually how democracies work. They don't understand the importance of governance. But keep in mind, the neoconservative movement actually came out of the left. The neoconservative movement was formed by old Trotskyites and hardline left folks left over from the 50s and 60s and early 70s, who then became the new left, and then they became the new right, and then they were labeled by I believe, a liberal as neoconservative. I don't remember the name of the guy who first used that word, but he wasn't one of them. It was a derisive term originally, and then people like Irving Kristol, Bill Kristol's father, adopted that and embraced that and said, yes, we are the neo. And at that time, that was as we were going into the so-called Reagan Revolution. At that time, the word conservative was really cool, so being a neoconservative sounded even better.
Okay.
And, you know, but
maybe,
that's the genesis of the whole thing.
So maybe it's just these liberals who, we have greedy liberals on our side too, and maybe it was these guys who said, well, you know, let's define democracy with more laissez-faire capitalism.
Yeah, they're like libertarians and the Ayn Rand folks. The problem is they are absolute idealists. They believe in a world that never has been and never will be, and they don't get the reality on the ground of just the fundamental needs of people. And spot on, Tom. Thank you very much for the call and for your comment. Well said. Doug in Royal Oak, Michigan. Hey, Doug.
Hey, Tom. Nice talking to you. Happy spring.
Thank you, and the same to you, Doug.
All right. Basically, you're pretty much spot on using that term as far as that goes. The neocon way of nation building obviously doesn't work, and I like the liberal way of nation building, which is like helping people and...
Right, it's the Marshall Plan.
And moving along. The Marshall Plan, exactly. And like I was saying to the screener, we're getting to the point where our economy is not going to support the liberal way of nation building because we just can't afford to do it for people anymore. It's unfortunate, but that's about what it
is. Well, and this is where we need to be bringing the rest of the world together. I mean, the Arab League has so much money. And Iraq and Afghanistan are right in their backyard. And with a half a week's oil revenue from the combined countries of the Gulf States, the combined non-combatant countries of the Gulf States, they could, in local currencies, probably start go a long way toward rebuilding every hospital and school in Afghanistan and Iraq. And as those institutions of civil society come alive, then democracy will come alive, not the other way around.
Right. And, of course, that leads to people looking to us as leaders of the world to do something about it. And that goes into the campaign. I mean, as a former Edwards supporter and now a marginal Obama supporter, but a definite Democratic supporter, I think Obama is starting to use the war is the economy stupid mantra versus.
Yeah.
It's definitely coming out. I think he wanted to save it for the general campaign because in mid to late October, it would have definitely hammered the point home. Unfortunately, he's going to have to use it to put Hillary away.
Yeah, well, I think it still will in mid to late October, barring an October surprise. And that's the big wild card. Doug, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Warren in New York City. Hey, Warren.
Hey, Tom. Just a couple of points. The reason I called was because, there's a Glenn Greenwald post up now that in which has a Charlie Rose interview with a couple of Iraqis who were talking about how the invasion was bound to fail to bring about a democratic regime principally because of the Maslow principle that the infrastructure had been bombed out in 1991, and then with the sanctions regime that had been in place for a dozen years, there was simply no way to meet basic needs.
Right. This is how during the Clinton years a half a million children died in Iraq.
Right. Exactly. And they bring this out very vividly. So I would recommend that people go to Glenn's site and look at that.
Glenn Greenwald.
Glenn Greenwald, yeah, he has something like what you can and can't say on television, something like that.
Yeah.
But
okay.
Just on the Straussians, can I say something?
Sure.
Because you picked up on this. I think that they are, there's something about what they do which is a little tricky, but it's very different than what you were saying. They are masters of doublespeak. I mean, they read everybody. They read Lincoln. They read Spinoza.
Leo Strauss recommended that. It's you trick people for their own good, for their own benefit. You know?
Right. And they have this whole reading of all these giants, and they say, well, they said one thing for the popular masses, but they really meant another.
Right.
And I think that's how to understand the way they use democracy. They are masters of, in Orwell, he says at one point in 1984 that the best users of doublethink are the inner party.
Right.
They're which is just a phrase for double talk.
Yeah, and this is what McCain's speech was yesterday.
And they are themselves tied up in their own socks. I mean, I think the better way to understand, I would not even give them the word democracy. Democracy is just an extension of the principle: if you do to other people what you would have them do to you.
Yeah.
Which is precisely.
Well, maybe we should call it chaos or anarchy, because really, I'd say that at a certain level, they are anarchists, and they believe that out of anarchy, something good will come, and it just doesn't work that way. Warren, your point is well made. Thank you very much. We're out of time here. John McCain again.
Must help expand the power and reach of freedom, using many of our strengths as a free people.
Yeah.
This This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Just a reminder, I'll be live from our affiliate KMPT 930 Missoula, Montana tomorrow. And for our listeners in Missoula at 2 o'clock tomorrow, I'll be giving a talk at the Holiday Inn Parkside at 200 South Patty in Missoula. Talk is free and open to the public, and I'll be signing copies of my books. The talk will be basically about my new book, Cracking the Code. Also, the Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy should be a right and not a privilege. Larry Adelman is with us. He is the executive producer of a new PBS 7-part miniseries, Unnatural Causes. Is Inequality Making Us Sick? Larry, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Very glad to have you with us. We've been talking in this hour about how if people's fundamental needs are not met in a country, then a democracy can't function well. And increasingly it seems that, you know, that's the kind of the political side of it. Increasingly it seems that as inequality spreads in America, as democracy is arguably diminished as a consequence of that, so is our health.
Well, Sir Michael Marmot, who is, despite his being knighted, is in fact one of the leading public health experts in the world, says the measure of a society could well be look at the measure of the health of its population.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great measure to use. And this is a show, you know, this is not Sicko. Sicko looked at our repair shops. Great film. Loved it. That's medical care. What this series looks at is why are we getting sick in the first place? What's causing the wear and tear in our engines? And why is that wear and tear so differentially distributed by race and by class?
So what is the cause of that wear and tear? Why are we getting sick? And, well, you know, let me just talk right back to you.
Well, all right. How many hours do we got here?
Well, you know, you can give us a tease, you know, the short version of it, the elevator speech.
Well, the thing is, there's no silver bullet. But the fact is, what's interesting is that, first of all, is that what researchers have found, and what's so interesting is that it's not just that there's the poor are sicker than the rich. I mean, what would be so surprising about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
You look at any homeless person, you know that the wear and tear of life on the street takes a toll.
Right.
But the wear and tear of also just trying to living from paycheck to paycheck takes a toll on the body. The wear and tear of being a middle manager takes a toll on the body. The wear and tear of having to drive the 2-hour commute to get to work and back takes a wear and tear in the body. That increasingly jobs don't have any job security, that you can be laid off at any time. And if you do, you're on your own. In those famous words of economist Jared Bernstein, you know, we're a yo-yo society. You're on your own.
Right.
And, of course, then you have at every So you have this gradient, this continuous gradient of pyramid. At every step on the pyramid, people tend, on average, to be sicker than those above them, and poor, better off than those beneath them.
It sounds almost like you're saying the wear and tear on the mind takes a wear and tear on the body as well.
Well, it's both.
Or on the emotions.
They work together. And what's interesting is that now you're getting into chronic stress, right?
Mm.
And that's part of the deal here. I mean, there's material deprivation. Obviously, if you can't eat your 5 to 7 fruits and vegetables a day because you live in a food desert, you know, where there's no supermarkets, only mom and pops and fast food, you got to take 2 unreliable buses to find some food. Or if you've got to go ahead and because of that commute, you don't have time, or you work 2 jobs, that's real deprivation. You can't eat well. Or if you've got to spend money for fresh fruits and vegetables, that is a lot more expensive than the calories you can get in Jack in the Box.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're driving at, and what's so interesting, and where a lot of the new research it takes us, is the way in which that chronic stress response is triggered because we don't have control over the forces that impinge upon our lives. You know, we've got this still in our head is imprinted this notion of the high-powered chief executive, the CEO who's dropping dead of heart attacks, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what we think of. It's not true.
The CEOs are actually doing quite well, thank you very much. The bottom end of Maslow's pyramid is covered for them.
There you go. It's the subordinates who are dropping dead. And that's the difference between pressure and stress. We all face pressure, right? Putting on this show, I'm sure, puts a lot of pressure on you.
Let me tell you about it.
But the question is whether or not you have the resources, you can access the resources to manage the pressures that impinge upon your life. So let's think about that CEO for a minute. A lot of pressure, right? What else has got that CEO, has the CEO have? Lots of advisors, lots of consultants, places he can go for help. The CEO, he or she gives orders, doesn't take orders. People out there beck and call, has powered lunches, I'm sure, are well-respected, well-remunerated, and when it's all over, can take that sailboat vacation to Aruba. They don't call for out-call massage. That's not an option that the rest of us have. The further down,
we don't all have the Elliot Spitzer option. Is that
what you're saying? Exactly. You know, we won't go there.
Yeah. Well, no. The point is that there is when Franklin Roosevelt back in 1936, when he was accepting his nomination for his second term as president, he said an old English judge once said, "A necessitous man is not a free man." In other words, if you don't know where your next meal is coming from, if you're concerned that you're one nasty word from your boss away from being homeless or losing your health care, then you're not free. And if you're not free, you're not unstressed, shall we say. You know, is the sequence making sense here? We have about a half a minute.
Okay, yeah. Take a woman who's got told the story of having to take a bus to drop her kid off at childcare, 45 minutes in one direction, 40 minutes in another direction to get to work. If she's late three times, if she's tardy three times, she's fired.
Right.
That's chronic stress.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the kind of thing that is grinding down Americans. And this is why Americans are not doing as well as, for example, the Swedes or the French or the Germans, where they have a fairly high level of job security.
Or even the Greeks or the Jordanians, people who are much poorer than us, or Costa Ricans live longer than us, Slovenians. We're now 29th in life expectancy time.
Right, because they have the social safety net and the economic social safety net that we don't, that we lack.
Well, they got that, and they have a commitment that we're in it together.
Yeah, there you go. Larry Adelman, Unnatural Causes is the series. Is Inequality Making Us Sick? The website, if you want to read all about it and get the dates and times and places and everything else, unnaturalcauses.org. Larry, thanks for dropping by.
Hey, thanks so much.
57 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? Now, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. The Democrats are fairly united in their notion that global warming is real, that this is a problem, and even beyond that, that pollution in and of itself, things like mercury in the air, carbon dioxide is as a pollutant, not necessarily a toxic pollutant, but a global greenhouse gas. And, you know, particulate matter, sulfur dioxide, things like this, acidifying our lakes and rivers, that this is all nasty stuff. Many Republicans are in agreement. And I've been trying to figure out from the McCain website whether McCain is in support of or not in support of this legislation, the America's Climate Security Act. And I haven't quite nailed it down yet. Perhaps Kerry Lucas will know. Kerry is the vice president for policy and economics of the Independent Women's Forum. And she's also the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Women, Sex, and Feminism, and a senior fellow at the Goldwater Institute, the website IWF.org. Kerry Lucas, welcome to our program.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks for coming back on. First of all, do you know, since we're talking about the Climate Security Act, do you know what John McCain's position is on it?
Sure. John McCain is a cap-and-trade guy. I don't know that he signed on to this specific bill, but he's actually been the lead sponsor of other versions of this bill in the past. So he is definitely walking in lockstep with the Democrats.
That was my understanding. I remember during one of the debates, he said words to the effect of, you know, even if you guys are right and there is no such thing as global warming, you know, if we clean up the environment and we cut our dependence on money, you know, stop giving money to sheikhs in Saudi Arabia or passing it along to Wahhabists, isn't that a good thing?
Sure. You know, and I think that that you know, there's actually more agreement on some of these issues, in that, of course, we all think that a cleaner environment is a good thing, but I think even a lot of environmentalists question whether or not the best, the most important use of our environmental dollar, if you will, is going after reducing carbon, because when it comes to reducing carbon, let's just assume for the sake of this, our little conversation here for the next few minutes, that global warming is happening and that it is a problem. One of the problems, though, is that these solutions, the things that people are putting into place to try to reverse global warming, actually have very little impact on, even if we had signed Kyoto, if everybody was following the Kyoto, if all countries were complying with Kyoto Protocol, it actually wouldn't make that much of a difference by the global warming alarmist's own metric. It's not going to make
The city of Portland, Oregon, is in complete compliance with Kyoto. The state of Oregon is in compliance with Kyoto. There are a number of states around the United States that are. It was a very small first step. It was a very small first step. But now this legislation has been put forward that would put the United States on a track of cutting carbon emissions by 2% per year. It actually provides, it also reduces output in sulfur dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, and mercury. And it takes some of the money from this let's tax the polluters system and takes some of that money and provides it to middle and low income families to help make up for any increased energy costs and to help, you know, things like, you know, reducing their energy costs with fluorescent bulbs and things like that. It puts money as an investment into zero and low carbon technologies. I don't get it why anybody other than the industries that make their money by externalizing the costs of pollution, in other words, not paying the costs of pollution, having you and me as taxpayers pay the costs of pollution, and then profiting from the processes that cause that pollution, the sale of carbon-based products, coal and oil and whatnot, why anybody other than them would be opposed to this? What's the Independent Women's Forum take? I mean,
sure,
why?
I mean, I think that because we're concerned about the economy as well as about the environment, and it's not just something, I mean, it's nice to say, okay, we're going to take some of the costs and then give it to low-income people, but we're not talking about little that everybody's costs are going to go up by $10 or something. This is looked at over the course of the next couple of decades. This would mean energy costs would double in real terms of what they are today. Our economy would be
well. They've tripled smaller since Bush came into office.
Well, I mean, that's okay. Fair enough. So let's assume that's Bush's fault. Why would we want to go ahead and make this double it again and put more hardship? And remember, when things like energy prices come up, that means that is hardest on low income folks and people on fixed income.
Right. So let's tax the polluters. Let's tax the people who are driving up these costs. ExxonMobil is the most profitable corporation in the history of the planet.
Okay,
I mean,
so
back to the Roman Empire, nobody's made so much money.
Okay, so let's. Corporations are all terrible. Are you really think that you're going to be able to tax these corporations and they're not going to find a way to pass it on to the consumers? Of course they are.
Yes, they are. They are not going to pass it along to the consumers. They're going to pay less money to their stockholders.
So you think they're much more charitable than I do, because I think that if...
No, that's not charity. That's what happens. When corporations don't make so much profit, they reduce the dividends to their stockholders.
Let's just talk about some of the other things that happen once we start raising the cost of putting pressure on corporations, because one of the things they're going to do is they're going to start cutting jobs.
And no, they're not. They're going to start innovating.
No. They'll also move overseas. You know as well as I do, and I'm sure you've been complaining about it on your radio program in the past, this problem of outsourcing.
No, look at what's happened in Europe. In Europe, they doubled the cost of energy back 20 years ago. I used to live in Europe. Gasoline 20 years ago was cost $5 a gallon in Europe. What did they do? They innovated. People figured out how to make houses that were more efficient, how to make cars that were more efficient. The average car in Europe right now gets around 43, 44, 45 miles per gallon. I mean, that is so far from anything that's even a goal of this legislation. That's simply because they raised the cost of energy.
Pretend for a second that you're one of these evil corporations and you're sitting there and you're deciding...
I don't think corporations are evil.
Okay, great. Neither do I. But I'm trying to work on your terms here. That you're a corporation and you're thinking about your bottom line. If you are living in a... If you have one country that has decided to significantly reduce, create a big disincentive to pollute, you can either keep your factory here and try to have these more stringent regulations or pay somebody else for polluting rights, or you can say, boy, you know what? I've been paying these high health care costs. I've been paying these really high wages because of unions here in the United States. I can take my company and go someplace else where I can pollute more freely, and I can hire lower cost of labor. These are all things.
Which is exactly what we see happen. And there's a third option, and that is to say, that's fine. You can take your factory offshore and make anything you want offshore, but when you import it into the United States, there's going to be a tariff on that import that's going to reflect what it would have cost if you had manufactured it in the United States.
Okay,
so you might as well make it here. We did that for over 200 years in the United States, and it worked.
We can get into a big free trade versus a protectionism conversation on another time, because I think that there's tremendous cost to trying to create barriers for goods coming from around the world.
It built this country.
Instead, we should be trying to make ourselves more competitive. But let me just make
Korea is doing that right now. Japan is doing that right now. China is doing that right now. I mean, if you want to import a U.S. car into China, that's a 20% import tariff. If you want to import a Chinese car into the United States, it's a 2% import tariff. Tell me what's wrong with that picture.
Lower costs and better quality goods that are available around the world.
It does not keep them out. It simply makes them more expensive so that people have an incentive to manufacture them here in the United States.
But obviously it raises prices. It makes it harder on consumers. You think about it. I know that you guys all hate
No, it increases the income to consumers, so they have more money to buy those things.
Okay, well, this is... I want to, if you don't mind, I would rather get back to this one other point that I think is really important when you think about this legislation and kind of the whole global warming debate. There's actually a really interesting book out there, and it's written by a guy that's called, his name is Bjorn Lomborg, and he's an environmentalist.
The skeptical environmentalist.
I don't agree with him on a whole lot of stuff, but when he looks at things like, I found it very interesting, when he looks at some things like global warming and looks at...
His book has been so thoroughly debunked, Carrie. I can't believe that you're quoting Bjorn Lomborg.
I mean, if you think that this is the best thing we can do for the environment, when you look at all the problems out there, that going ahead and spending hundreds of billions of dollars over the next 20 years on global warming to reduce, at best, to reduce the rate of increase of our temperature by less than a percentage point, by less than 1 degree, if you think that's the best thing we can do with hundreds of billions of dollars, then go ahead. This is a great legislation for you.
I think it is, frankly, and I'm wondering why the Independent Women's Forum is not in favor of making our air cleaner and making the future of the world more secure.
Boy, that's a ridiculous question, of course. This is not, first of all, we can get into the politicalization of the global warming debate. But I also think that this is something you really do have to think about, what our top priorities are. Let's face it, from around the world, there's much greater environmental problems out there. From the problems of malaria in Africa and the use of, the potential for...
Which ties into global warming, actually. I was in Africa 2 weeks ago. Desertification and malaria are moving as a consequence of global warming.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that we should really look at... People only hear one side of the story when it comes to global warming from the media, and it's all this tremendously debunked alarmism of guys like Al Gore. And instead, we really need to talk about the cost and weigh the costs and the benefits, because there's some big costs that come with legislation like this, and the benefits are really thin.
I understand your point, Carrie, and thank you for making it so articulately and eloquently. People can check it out at IWF, the Independent Women's Forum, .org. Carrie Lucas, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. The true people's radio. Tom Hartman.
Well, I'm still in Tulsa, Texas. Just asking any bar. Although I screwed the country, they still think I'm a star. Hear neighbors trust their neighbors. That's why I tap their phones. It keeps their freedom ringing. And I feel less alone. Even though I love them, that's just where I'm at. Besides, rumor has it that one's a Democrat. Let's go to Mars. Forget about
it. Yes, George, why don't you do that? Sounds like a fine idea. I remember when he said that in his State of the Union address, let's go to Mars. It's like, what? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Tom Hartman program bringing you the real issues, the big issues. And also, talking about the day-to-day stuff, like a couple of interesting things in the news this morning. This morning, Reverend Snyder, the senior minister at Foundry United Methodist Church in Washington, D.C. This is Hillary Clinton's former church. released a statement praising his colleague, Reverend Wright, as an outstanding church leader who has been a profound voice for justice and inclusion in our society. This is Hillary Clinton's pastor saying this. Snyder said that while he may not agree with everything Wright has said, this from MSNBC, he believes that the church in America is stronger today because of Wright's leadership. Very interesting. And there's some speculation out there. Barack Obama is being introduced today at an economic forum by Michael Bloomberg. Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York. And might that make an interesting ticket? Obama Bloomberg. And one of the things that one of this commentary over actually at the Huffington Post, a very interesting kind of summary. Well, actually, this is MSNBC's first read reports. But it will be the potential of Obama Bloomberg that could be the most important takeaway. In fact, considering the anti-Israel sentiments being expressed by the Reverend Wright in these newly circulating church bulletins, see Andrea Mitchell's reporting on today below in the Obama section. A fortunate thing for Obama is at least these church bulletins aren't in video. The idea of a Jewish running mate might end up making more and more sense for Obama as the summer wears on. You know, Michael Bloomberg, what little I know of him, he seems like a relatively decent guy for somebody who was a Democrat and then a Republican and now an independent. And my friend Jerry Schneiderman, who lives in New York and has his entire life, my best friend, or one of my absolute best friends, for decades, and a stalwart and firm Democrat, has said to me on a number of occasions he thinks Bloomberg is a damn good mayor. So, gee, I don't know. Would he be a good vice presidential candidate with Barack Obama? I don't know. Dan in Los Angeles, 866-303-2270. Hey, Dan, listening on K-Talk. What's up?
I just wanted to comment on the previous guest you had, that young woman. She sounded pretty young anyway. And I couldn't help but think that she reminded me of Republicans I knew in college. And they begin to drink the ideology of the free market, and they just don't want to be confused with facts. I noticed that every time you said something, for example, the United States built up its standard of living by being protectionist, the fact that Korea is protectionist, Japan is protectionist, China is protectionist, she just plowed on. She ignored what you were saying.
Yeah.
And it was a little bit funny to me, because as I could imagine her preparing for this interview with you, you know, getting all her little note cards together and thinking of the most efficient way to reach.
Well, yeah, I have to say, Dan, I was actually impressed by Carrie Lucas. I think at some points she would just kind of back away from that because she knew that it would take more time than we had to really go down one of those trails to have the debate. And I look forward, frankly, to future debates with her on some of those specific issues, because she's really smart. I mean, this is a woman who really knows her stuff. I disagree with her on the issues. I think she's wrong. I think history demonstrates that she's wrong. But she believes she's right, and she thinks that she has facts at her
disposal. If you believe she's wrong, how can she know her stuff?
She knows her stuff from her point of view.
What I
meant.
I wasn't impressed at all. I've heard people who argue her point much better than her. If you're wrong, how can you know your stuff? You know, that's all I'm saying.
Okay.
But it was interesting to listen to her, because it took me right back to, you know, junior year of college and fanatical little Republican free marketers, growing up and drinking it all in.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Dan, for the call. I don't want to trash my guests when they're not here to defend themselves, so we'll just leave it at that. Pam in Lakewood, Washington. Hey, Pam, we got about a half a minute before this break here at the bottom of the hour.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, I hope you're feeling better.
I am.
I kind of came on as soon as you started decoding Tom McCain's speech.
John McCain.
John McCain's speech, which really excited me, because I think we need to do it further. I think he's going to be doing more of this, and it scared me so much that, so many Obama and Clinton supporters are talking about voting for McCain, and also the papers have been reporting this as an olive branch kind of that he's extending, and I think decoding his speech in terms of what the neocons have done all through South America and so forth in terms of overturning democracies and making sure that Friedman's policies were put in place instead is really important. And I think we need to keep going back to this because
I don't
believe they really want a democracy at all that doesn't support free trade, a free trade capital.
Yeah, well, I think Tom from Minneapolis was right. What they want is some sort of an economic system that they think is democracy and really is laissez-faire capitalism.
Right.
Pam, I gotta take a break, but your point was really well made, and I appreciate your calling to make it. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. So I mentioned I didn't know that much about Mike Bloomberg, other than what friends of mine in New York City say. And there seems to be some ambivalence around there. Mark in New York has the inside scoop. Let's see, WWRL. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hi, how you doing?
I'm great.
Yeah, you mentioned something about Michael Bloomberg. During the Republican convention, they were rounding up protesters and arresting them for nothing. They ended up having to settle with a lot of people that were just arrested falsely. They introduced false evidence. And just like last week or the week before, he gave $500,000 to the New York Republican Party. So I just think the idea of him as a running mate for Obama is just unbelievably a bad idea.
So he's not the knight on. I was there for the Republican convention in New York staying right across the street from Madison Square Garden and on 8th Avenue at my friend Jerry's apartment. And we could see the protesters being busted and rounded up. And I was on the ground, and sometimes you're absolutely right that was going on. And
yeah,
thank
and
you for the reminder.
Protest piece, like they tried to get a permit to protest in Central Park, and they wouldn't allow that.
Yeah.
And yeah, they were using this orange fence, like those things you could roll up, and they were just rounding up people on bicycles.
Yeah,
and saying
yeah.
that they were doing, mayhem and whatnot.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right, and I recall it well. And thanks for the reality check.
Well,
we all
for
need it.
I like your show very much, and you're extremely smart, and it's great that you're on.
Thank you, Mark. I'm very pleased to be there. Andrew in Hollywood, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Andrew.
Hello?
You have some thoughts on Mayor Bloomberg as well.
Oh, yeah, it was basically a lot of the same thing, and then they made a free speech zone on the freeway where nobody could see these people.
Yeah.
And I admire your sobriety in listening to that lady rattle off facts and figures that seemed so hurly-burly, and you just sort of stopped her at every turn. So let me just salute your sobriety.
Thank you. I'm not sure that's the word I would always use, but at least on the air it is. But Andrew, thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's very, very kind of you to say so. Rob in Seattle. Hey, Rob. Rob?
Hey.
No, Rob. Oh, there's Rob. Hey, Rob.
Hello,
what's
here.
Up?
Hello,
you're on
Tom?
The air. You're on the air, sir.
Yeah, I wanted to say, I appreciate one of the earlier callers talked about, taking a hard look at what McCain, is saying in this most recent coverage he's got.
Right, and we're trying to do this every day on this show from now on out, is take some aspect of what McCain is up to and talk about it, because that's what I want Clinton and Obama to be talking about. That's what I think we all need to be talking about. We all need to be focusing on, as well as the other stuff that's going on. But let's take on Mr. McCain. Thank you very
much.
Yeah,
the message here is, a half-truth is more dangerous than an outright lie. This is just Karl Rove, 400-level college courses.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Well, and this is Leo Strauss 101, too. It's
absolutely.
Leo Strauss's worldview, and we had a caller earlier who accurately pointed this out. In fact, one of the better books on Leo Strauss, and the title is Leo Strauss, and then there was a subtitle that I don't remember, but it was one of my BuzzFlash books of the month a year or two ago. And if you go over to BuzzFlash.com, you can track back and find it. It's still, they're still selling most of those books. And you get it that this guy was so convinced, this University of Chicago professor, Leo Strauss, who came to the United States, as I recall, from Germany in the 30s, and had this worldview or perhaps after. I don't believe he was a Holocaust survivor. I believe he came he got out before that. But in any case, he had this worldview that forged in part by the Hitler experience, that humanity is so fundamentally evil that the truly few elite good people have to take over, and they have to do it in a way that makes it look like it's democratic, and that the noble lie is actually not just a good thing but a necessary thing, because you know the rabble, as John Adams would call you and me, the rabble can't be trusted.
Right, to protect us from ourselves.
Exactly.
But you know, as this Ellen is Rappin on a 101 level. This is a very polished thing. It's a very
that speech
move to grab the middle of the Democratic Party. You know, anybody who's might be a little disenchanted right now with infighting. You know, I tell Dems, don't worry about it. We're just cleaning a little house, and yeah, the character of everything could come up a little. But I think you know when this all plays out. I personally am an Obama delegate, and you know I don't let that. I was not entranced with Hillary before any of the other players start dropping out.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, this is all going to come out in the wash. Rob, thanks a lot for your call and your comments. Well said. Christy in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Christy, thanks for waiting for so long and for listening to WLBY.
It's okay. This is important to me. I'm one of those Michigan disenfranchised voters who didn't vote because we were told their votes wouldn't count.
Mm-hmm.
And this is causing great rifts between friends, people who support Hillary and people who support Obama.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, Hillary is blaming Obama for failing to okay her attempt to do a redo in Michigan. However, her idea for a redo involves her campaign supporters paying for it,
right,
which isn't clean.
Yeah, I think that there's a consensus on that. That's why the Democratic Party turned it down.
Right, but she continues to blame Obama.
Yeah, well, you know, what's going to happen is that the people who think that it's an okay and appropriate thing to do it the way that she suggested will continue to think that. And the people who think that, you know, gee, that probably wasn't all that appropriate, maybe they should have come up with something else or whatever, will continue to think that. But your point is made, Christian. And, I don't know what to say other than just agreeing with you and thank you for calling and making it. Jeff in Gig Harbor, Washington. Hey, Jeff.
Oh, hey. This whole talk about the environment has really kind of got me thinking. I'm sorry it's a little bit late, but with this whole situation about the Arctic collapsing at this point, with this
right.
Massive seven times chunk just floating away.
Seven times the size of Manhattan, yeah.
Yeah, and at this point I've realized that, you know, corporate America and these giants just have such deep pockets and they're reaching so far into the government that it's really kind of falling back on us. We're the ones that are going to have to take care of it. We're going to have to make our own personal changes. And what I've come to realize was, personal changes will make a big difference. And some of my friends over in Seattle have been working on a site. It's called carboncontest.com.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of a social networking site, and it allows you to go through calculations and all sorts of different calculators in order to figure out what your carbon footprint is.
Cool, that's great. At carboncontest.com. Jeff, I've got to move along, but thanks for letting me know about it. And I suspect we're going to see a lot more of these kind of things popping up, and a fine thing it is. Ed in Kansas. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Thomas, Dr. Ed out in Kansas. Listen, your lady that was talking about I'm not sure what she was talking about, but she sure seemed to have a right-wing spin on everything.
Carrie Lucas. Well, her opinion was that this legislation that would put, you know, basically cap-and-trade legislation is going to be a burden on industry and therefore harm the economy. I mean, that's her talking points in us.
We have to look at it in our economy is what can we do? She has no faith in American ingenuity. I would ask people to go to Google and Google nanosolar, nanosolar. That's one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And another one is Coscata, Coskata.
Mm-hmm.
NanoSolar has figured out how to make solar panels using an inkjet method that does no longer take
right.
high vacuum and clean.
Right, they're basically printing solar panels.
They print out these huge panels,
yeah.
But they're sold out for a year, and they're all going to Germany.
Yeah. Well, and because Germany has put together this very innovative and brilliant, Ed, thanks for making that point, this extraordinary program where they say you can sell your electricity. If you generate electricity off your rooftop, you can sell that electricity back to the power company. The power company has to pay you 7 times retail for it. And the bank is required, it's actually subsidized by the government, so there's no risk to the bank, is required to give you a mortgage on solar panels on your roof. This is for a 10-year period, the 7 times payback. And for a 10-year period, you can get a 10-year mortgage for solar panels to put on your roof. And the bank's required to do that at, I think it's a 1.5% or 2% interest rate, again, subsidized by the government. So the banks have no risk, and they can make a small profit on this thing. And at the end of 10 years, the 7 times... the retail rate that you're selling the electricity back to the utility at works out typically to the exact cost of the monthly mortgage payment for the solar panels. So you're putting up a solar panel with a 50-year lifespan. Over a 10-year period, it's paying for itself 100%. At the end of 10 years, it drops down to, you know, the power company has to pay you at 100%. But at the end of 10 years, you've got basically free electricity for the next 40 years. And all across Germany, you take the train across Germany and you see at least every third house. And in some towns, 2/3 of the houses are just, the entire southern side are covered with solar panels. I mean, real estate properties, the value of real estate is changing in Germany based on whether or not there's southern exposure. And this is a country that, I live there. This is a country that is cloudy most of the year, that has less sunshine than Oregon, that is cold in the winter. I mean, it's a country that you would think solar? Germany? And yet they are the now the world's leading consumer, one of the world's leading consumers of solar panels. China is also doing this. China has started a plan to solarize 3 million homes. They're starting with 3 million homes, and they're talking about 300 million homes within the next 20 years, and doing the exact same thing. 45 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you by you, our listeners. Supporting your local radio station, letting them know you're listening, putting their bumper stickers on your car, telling your friends, supporting their advertisers, and supporting the advertisers, of course, of our network, as well as including the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. And one of our regular features here is to bring an advertiser on to demonstrate that Progressive Talk Radio actually does work and give them a moment to plug their product. Huma Gruaz is with us. She is the president of Alpatac Marketing. Do I have that right?
Yes.
And this is the Shark EuroPro Floor Cleaner. SharkVac, SharkVac.com is the website. And I got to tell you, Huma, you are the first woman, look, my wife said, Louise says, tell her that she's the first woman who ever got you to mop the floor. I know that sounds terribly sexist, but I actually used your product. I mean, you're an advertiser, and this is such a cool contraption. No chemicals, no god-awful things to be inhaling. I mean, and it just zapped our kitchen floor. Tell us about the product.
Yeah, it's. We hope that this product is going to really, really change the way Americans are cleaning their homes, and it is already. It's one of the most popular products on the market right now. It's flying off the shelves. It's basically the Shark Steam Mop turns simple tap water into a powerful steam cleaner, and the robust steam combined with a super absorbent microfiber lifts messes off the floors and locks them away into the pad. The floors dry instantly. The fantastic thing about this product, you do not need any chemicals.
Right.
So no chemical film residue. And I would like to tell you that over 150 chemicals found in the average home have been linked to allergies, birth defects, cancer, according to the Consumer Product Safety Commission. So if you care about your home, home health and also the health of the environment. This is a fantastic product.
I agree. And having used it, and we have one, and we use it regularly, I absolutely agree. And people can check it out at sharkvac.com, S-H-A-R-K-V-A-C.com, the Shark EuroPro floor cleaner. And Huma, what's your experience been advertising on Progressive Talk Radio?
First of all, the ads have produced a very positive result for EuroPro, driving consumers to the store and to the Shark Steam Mop's website. And I think this is also because the Steam Mop spots resonate with the environmentally conscious audience of Air America. You know, your audience cares not only about the environment, but I think about the well-being of their family. And it really resonated with them. And I also want to say that there's a specific website that's called the sharksteammop.com for the Steam Mop. And
okay.
I encourage everybody who cares about the health and well-being of their home to try this product. It's fantastic.
And sharksteammop.com is the best website?
Yes, sharksteammop.com.
Huma, thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, yeah. My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Great talking with you. And thank
you for, have a great
thank
day.
You for advertising and supporting Progressive Talk Radio. 53 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270. Stuart in West Seattle, Washington. Hey, Stuart, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, you neglected an important point when talking to that woman earlier who thinks that the polluters shouldn't have to pay while the rest of us pay.
You're talking about Carrie Lucas from the Independent Women's Forum.
Yes, exactly. When large corporations that pollute or otherwise do things that cost everyone else money and get away with it, when they get away with not paying the costs, they unfairly compete with the small and local and independent businesses.
Excellent point.
When those small and local independent businesses can compete, they produce a lot more jobs for our communities than those big corporations do for every dollar.
Excellent point. And these large corporations, they don't, the CEOs don't have to live in the community. They don't have to face the local community. They don't have to deal with their own pollution. You won't find the CEOs of the big chemical companies living in Cancer Alley in Louisiana, those kinds of things. And so what these guys are doing is it's called internalizing profits and externalizing costs. In other words, they bring the profit into the company and they dump the cost on the taxpayers and the citizens, the cost being, in this case, cancer and global warming and asthma and all the other things associated with it. And if we can force them through legislation to actually pay the costs, to bear the costs, rather than externalizing them on us, then it provides a level playing field for smaller companies. Excellent point, Stuart. Thank you so much for calling and making it. I appreciate it. Anthony in Seattle. Hey, Anthony, what's on your mind?
Oh, I actually have a question for you.
Okay.
At the very beginning of your program today, you were talking about this uprising in Basra.
Yes.
And now
Baghdad as well.
And I guess my question is, I thought we were paying the militia, the Mahdi army, I guess. Is that Muqtada al-Sadr's militia? Is that what
it is? And we were not paying them. We were paying the Sunnis. We were paying the guys who used to work with Saddam Hussein.
I thought we were paying the Mahdi army not to basically attack us.
No. No, to the best of my knowledge, no. There may be some backdoor arrangement or deal, but basically a ceasefire had been called. Keep in mind, Muqtada al-Sadr controls about a third of all the seats in parliament. He's a major political force, and so I'm sure that there's a considerable amount of government largesse, you know, departments and, you know, emoluments of various kinds, as James Madison would say, that had been passed out to him and his buddies. But it's the Sunnis that we were paying directly.
I guess my question is, I have not heard in a while the solution for all of this violence, which was the three-state solution, which was to divide the country into Sunni, Shia, and then in the north you had the Kurds,
right.
And then you had this central government, and everybody would share in the oil revenues, and right. I just don't understand why this has not been implemented. I mean, why we can't pull our troops out, you know, separate the country, have this, basically everything.
Because, the reason why is because Joe Biden isn't president. I mean, you know, Joe Biden put that proposal forward initially. It's been picked up by a lot of people. I think it's a very wise and solid proposal, or at least a wise and solid beginning point. There is the problem, particularly in the city of Baghdad, where during the Saddam regime, the mixing of Sunni and Shia through marriage was encouraged. And there are a lot of kind of blended families that this could tear apart quite badly. But by and large, it does seem like this three-state solution is probably what we're going to end up with no matter what. And the Bushies just, you know, don't want to talk about it, don't want to look at it. They say that would be admitting defeat. Anthony, thanks for the call. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Where smart people get their news.
6 minutes past the hour. 10 days that changed capitalism. David Wessel on the front page of today's Wall Street Journal. The past 10 days will be remembered as the time the U.S. government discarded a half century of rules to save American financial capitalism from collapse. Something big happened. It happened without an explicit vote by Congress. A Republican administration, not eager to be viewed as the second coming of the Hoover administration, showed it no longer believes the market can sort out the mess. And then he talks about how the Treasury has forced the sale of Bear Stearns. The Fed agreed to take losses or gains up to $29 billion on the Bear Stearns portfolio securities. And the Fed lent money directly to Wall Street security firms for the first time. Is this the direct consequence of Clinton in 98, I believe it was, signing away the Glass-Steagall Act? What's going on here? David Walker is the former Comptroller General of the United States. He's currently president and CEO of the Peter G. Peterson Foundation. And, sir, welcome to the program.
Tom, good to be with you.
Thank you. Is there a website, by the way, that you'd like our listeners to know about for your foundation?
PeterGPetersonFoundation.org.
Great. Thank you very much. I know that much of the public speaking and whatnot you're doing right now is focused around the what you perceive to be as a crisis with Social Security and Medicare, and that your solutions are by and large for government to get out of those businesses.
We're not talking about getting out of the businesses, but we clearly need to restructure those programs, to modernize them, and to make sure that the government can deliver on the promises that it makes. You know, government is great about making promises that it can't deliver on.
Yeah, well, there seems to be a history of that. On the other hand, government has, in many cases, delivered on promises very well. I mean, we successfully fought World War II, for example, and I don't think that we've ever missed a Social Security check, but I acknowledge your concern, and we can discuss that in some detail if you wish.
Right.
But first, I'm curious about your take on these two articles in today's Wall Street Journal really popped my eyeballs. This first one by David Wessel, which I just shared, and then this piece by Justin Lehart on page A6, the headline, Busy Fed Might Need to Reload, and then the caption to this graph that shows that the Fed had $800 billion in treasuries a year ago, March, and now they're down to $679.9 billion, and they're fixing to auction off another $200 billion in treasuries. And they say, recent moves by the Federal Reserve to bolster the financial system have required tapping into its treasury holdings. And the first sentence of the article, the Federal Reserve has been so busy pulling out the stops, there's rising concern it may run out of stops to pull. What's going on?
Well, it's a new ball game. You know, I think clearly we've seen, you know, a lot of changes with regard to the markets and different instruments that are available now. There's not a tremendous amount of transparency with regard to a lot of these instruments. That was one of the big problems with regard to the subprime issue. I mean, I think the markets in many cases have been very volatile because we really don't know how much exposure there is, and people don't know who has exposure, if you will. We saw the Fed within the last week or so take unprecedented steps, some would say questionable steps, given the fact that these aren't insured institutions. At the same time, they wanted to prevent a meltdown, and you're going to see congressional hearings on determining what's the appropriate scope of authority for the Fed going forward. You know, markets are, I quit believing in the efficient market theory several years ago when we started getting triple-digit swings in opposite directions within a matter of days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. The fact of the matter is there is no such thing as a free market. Markets exist on a substrate of laws and regulations. They exist on a currency that is created by a country. They exist, you know, in a variety of contexts that have to do with the laws about tariffs and international trade. I mean, there's so many things that are necessary to create a market that you know, markets are unique. I mean, the market between Japan and South Korea, for example, is very different than the market between, you know, Massachusetts and Texas. There is no such thing as a free market. It's just,
But Tom, one of the things you need, even in order for a market to work, is you need adequate transparency. You need,
right.
You need timely, accurate, and useful information so that people can make informed decisions as to value and risk. And one
Absolutely.
Of the reasons that we have the problem that we have now is we didn't have that with a lot of these securitization arrangements.
Well, wouldn't it be more accurate to say that we haven't had that over the last 15 to 20 years that we have been that the problem that you just described is the exact same problem we had in the 1920s when there was, you know, back in the teens, there were these massive tax cuts at the top end in 1911, 1912, 1913. And then there was basically a lack of regulation during that whole period leading up to Wilson's presidency. And then after World War I, it began again through the 20s. And that lack of transparency in Wall Street led to the Great Depression, and that we have it again as a consequence of Reagan's deregulation zeal being then picked up by Bush and then being picked up by Clinton and now being carried forward with Bush from the end of the Glass-Steagall Act to other, you know, a whole variety of other things. I mean, there was a press conference 3 years ago, maybe you were there, where the guy showed up with a chainsaw to say we're here to cut some red tape, and they were deregulating the banking industry.
No, I wasn't there. But the fact is, it is a new ball game, and there's clearly evidence of the fact that there are gaps in our current oversight and regulatory system right now. They manifested themselves with regard to the current subprime mortgage problem, and that's clearly something that we have to take a look at. You know, there's been tremendous changes. I mean, you know, there are the lines have grayed tremendously between many different types of financial institutions, and I think we have to rethink about what's the proper role and responsibility for a number of players, including the Fed.
This morning, the Oregonian, our local newspaper here in Oregon, although our show is broadcast nationally, I'm sitting in a studio in Portland, Oregon.
It's a beautiful city.
It is. The Oregonian broke a story. They got a hold of a memo from inside J.P. Morgan Chase, as I recall, that basically taught people how to trick their computer into approving a mortgage for somebody that for whom the mortgage should not be approved. Isn't it time for us to say, let's seriously look again at some of the really substantial reforms that were put into place during the New Deal as a way of, you know, I mean, that successfully stopped the hemorrhaging of the banking system. Haven't we learned these lessons before?
Well, there are a lot of lessons from history that we don't seem to have learned. And, you know, frankly, that's one of the things that I think we need to refocus on. You know, there will undoubtedly be a range of studies, a range of congressional hearings, a range of, you know, research papers and everything else here. But, you know, frankly, one of the concerns that I have, Tom, is we're all focused on the current, quote unquote, subprime crisis, but we actually have a much bigger subprime crisis. And that's how the federal government handles its finances. You know, there are a lot of analogies between what the conditions that have come together to cause the problems of the mortgage subprime and the collapse of Bear Stearns.
You're talking about the $9 to $10 trillion debt that we have, the
$60 to $70 trillion
unfunded mandates.
Let's talk about a little the fact that, you know, one of the things that happened with the mortgage subprimes, the people who were originating the loans and who were making all the money on the origination fees were not the people who bore the risk. So there was a fundamental separation between who was making the money and who was benefiting the short term and who was going to bear the risk and pay the price in the long term. That's what's going on with the fact that we are making promises and spending money that we don't have, and we are expecting our kids, grandkids, and future generations unborn to pay it. Secondly, there's not enough transparency. You know, people talk about the fact that, gee, we've got a $9.2 trillion debt. Well, that may be true, but we've got $44 trillion in unfunded promises that people aren't paying attention to, and that's the real problem, not the $9.2 trillion in debt, okay?
But that $44 trillion, you're talking about Medicare and Social Security there.
Right.
If we were to turn this from a capped tax, a tax only on working people, only on the middle class, basically, up to $98,000, I think, right now, is Social Security limit, and into a flat tax, I mean, just a flat tax, not even a progressive tax, and just say, you know, Bill Gates pays the same Social Security rate that the average working Joe does, wouldn't that, over the mandate period that you're talking about, generate far more than $44 trillion?
Well, it depends on what the tax rate would be. Right now, as you know,
Tom, at current rates.
No, I don't believe it would. I mean, I haven't sat down and done the math, but here's the issue. Social Security does not face a crisis. It's got a problem. We can deal with it. It's not that complicated. We just need to get on dealing with it sooner rather than later. The real problem is Medicare and health care.
Mm-hmm.
That's what could bankrupt the country.
Okay.
You know, and we've got situations where people are out there still making unfunded promises. Look what happened with Medicare prescription drugs, $8 trillion.
Yeah. Well, and that was just pigs at the trough. I mean, you know, Billy Towson pushing that thing through so that the government couldn't negotiate prices. It's nuts. It's absolutely nuts. David Walker, he is now the president of the Peter G. Peterson Foundation, petersgpetersonfoundation.org, the former Comptroller General of the United States. Sir, thank you so much for dropping by.
Thank you so much, Tom. Bye-bye.
Good talking to you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman, speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Hey!
We're going to 5 o'clock world. You need a union. Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Well, the New York Times had an article, this was last Sunday, March 23rd. Depression, you say? Check those safety nets. And then the subtitle, the haunting word, depression, begins to surface. Why economists don't see an abyss. And the essence of the article is that we have this wonderful social safety net. But whatever name economists give the current downturn, we are unlikely to see the breadlines, shantytowns, and dust bowl of the Great Depression. More likely, these economists say, would be a sudden increase in the number of people selling belongings on eBay. So that's the take from the New York Times, from an article by Charles Duhigg, I believe it is, or Duhigg. Here's the take from the BBC that actually sent a film crew over here, and the pictures that go along with this is a videotape. You'll hear the audio part of it, but the pictures of it are of tents in a city park and in a large, just, you know, gravel area underneath a bunch of highways, where a bunch of highways cross each other, of people living literally in pup tents, and in some cases in lean-tos, you know, made out of everything from cardboard. I mean, you know, literally little shanty towns.
This is the reality of the crisis in the U.S. economy. People who used to own their own homes are living hand-to-mouth on land once occupied by those less fortunate. In the last month, some 60,000 houses were repossessed, their occupants forced out when they could no longer meet ever-increasing mortgage payments. Now they shower at a local church and get by on handouts. They have nowhere else to go, and it's a difficult adjustment, but some are determined to get back on track.
Once I do get a job full-time, instead of just one day a week, I'll be able to save my money and get a car to make it easier to go back and forth to work.
This woman used to live in a three-bedroom, two-bathroom house, but when her husband fell ill, it became impossible to make ends meet. Now they live in a mobile home at the camp, and family visits are a thing of the past.
We have a lot of grandkids, too. And they used to always come over and stay and stuff. They don't come here. I don't want them to come here. We go there and see them at their house.
Others, too, are finding it difficult to let go of what they once had.
I lost a home, settled all my bills, sold it for, which was nothing compared to what I bought it for, and now I'm homeless. And that's kind of hard for me to come by here and see my home.
It's a grim situation, and with more and more people joining the camp every day, it's one that's likely to get worse before it gets better. Wendy Urquhart, BBC News.
And this is a report from Los Angeles. And not only that, it's happening to pets as well. USA Today. Foreclosures slam door on pets, too. They're arriving by the thousands every month. Homeless, hapless victims of foreclosure. Precise numbers are unknown because there's no nationwide standard for recording foreclosure pets, and because many owners who surrender animals at shelters tell personnel only that they are moving and give no specifics. But shelters are experiencing an increase in pet intakes, almost without exception, in areas where the foreclosure rate is high. And the ASPCA talking about this, one example they had, two dogs together that had always lived together, and they're trying to give them out together. I mean, this is just, it's tough on humans, it's tough on pets, it's tough all around. Welcome to the wonderful world of Reaganomics. Richard in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Richard, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Oh,
yes,
my gosh, I've been listening to you for years.
Thank you.
I'm like, spellbound. Oh, my gosh. How do I say this?
Well, let's get to the point.
Yes, to the point. I sold my house in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Thank God. Because I can't sell my house in Florida. And I'm trying to get a mortgage to buy a house in Las Cruces. And I may not be able to do that. So I may have to go back to Florida. And I don't want to do that.
Yeah, well, at least you have a house to go back to. I mean, there's a lot of people who are literally going to pup tents.
Well, I'm not broke yet, but they're trying to get me broke.
Yeah.
That's what they're trying to do.
I got to tell you, Richard, you're not alone. I mean, this is the giant vacuum cleaner, the giant sucking sound, taking down the middle class and enriching the guys at the top 1%ers. Richard, thank you very much for the call and for your kind words. I appreciate it. Carlana in Pittsburgh, we have a half a minute here before this break. What's up, Carlana?
All right. Well, I'm inviting everybody in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Ohio to come to our march this Saturday in Oakland. We shut down about 20 blocks. It starts at 5th and Craig Street in Oakland, and we end up at Flagstaff Hill for a memorial service at 2:30 for all the victims of the Iraq War.
And this will be on March 29th.
Yes, it's just hours from now, and I want everybody in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Ohio to come. And again, it's in Oakland, which is where CMU and the University of Pittsburgh are at.
Great. Huge anti-war march coming up this Saturday. Is there a website, Carlana?
It's Fifth Avenue and Craig is where we start.
Oh, just show up at Fifth Avenue and Craig on the 29th, on Saturday, at what time?
1 o'clock.
At 1 o'clock. Great. Right. Thanks a lot, Carlana.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening on WPTT. 27 minutes past the hour. Christy Harvey with the Center for American Progress up next.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Sounds like a fine plan. How about sending back my democracy? I want a vax. And we're going to take it back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Christy Harvey, the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, and MyCheck Radio, MyCheckRadio.org, on the line with us. Hey, Christy.
Welcome home. I haven't talked to you in forever, it feels like.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
So glad to hear you.
It's good to be back, and it's so nice to hear you as well.
Thank you.
War on the rocks with salt.
Yeah, it's not going to be quite so nice to hear me once I tell you my depressing and horrible stories of the week. This was, I thought, pretty incredible. The L.A. Times did an interview with Marine Lieutenant General Michael DeLong, and he explained how he and Army General Tommy Franks decided that they would back Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney in the push to go to war in Iraq back in late 2002.
Okay, so we're talking now about how two of the top commanders, or the two top commanders in our military, made this momentous decision to commit hundreds of thousands, ultimately perhaps as many as a million Americans over time, over a period of years, to exposure to battle and combat and leading to tens of thousands of injuries and more than 4,000 deaths now of American soldiers, not to mention hundreds of thousands of dead Iraqis and millions of Iraqi casualties.
Why, yes.
How these guys made this momentous decision.
That's and they weren't sure if they should. They didn't really think the evidence was there. They weren't quite sure that the capability was there. And so this is Michael DeLong, the Marine Lieutenant General, said, and I'm quoting, "Well, General Franks likes margaritas, and I've got a margarita recipe. Of course, I'm a tequila connoisseur. And so we sat down and had margaritas and tequila and walked through, is this the right thing for us to do for the country? Can we look the troops in the eye and say you're going to die tomorrow? Here's why." And the answer was yes.
In other words, they had to get drunk to make this decision?
I mean, I've said yes to some pretty stupid stuff when I had too much tequila, too. You know, that's what tequila does.
Haven't we all?
You know, when you're making decisions, I'm not quite sure, you know, drinking the worm is exactly what you're supposed to sit down and do. So, yeah, basically, if you read this very, and it was in this big article just about the push to war, and it, you know, came on the heels of the five-year anniversary and the commemoration of the 4,000th American killed over there. And then there's this quote in the middle of this article about how, you know, they sat down and had margaritas.
Amazing. Now, to move along, the average congressional salary these days is probably, what, in the neighborhood of around $150,000 a year?
Uh-huh. Yep.
And there's more or less about 500 of them between the House and the Senate?
Right.
So 500 times 150, that would be, what, $7.5 million? I can't do math that fast. I think it would be $75 million a year that we pay in salaries to members of Congress. And, you know, $75 million a year buys us our Congress, pays for the salaries for our Congress. But there's a shadow economy operating in Washington, D.C.
Of course there is. Absolutely.
There's some people making a lot more than the members of Congress.
National Journal sat down and crunched the numbers earlier this week, and they found out that federal lobbyists, these are the guys who work to influence these members of Congress, they pulled in $2.9 billion in fees last year. And this is why this is interesting. A, that's about double what lobbyists made about 10 years ago. So over the last decade, the amount of money that lobbyists pull in to try and influence Congress has doubled.
Mm-hmm.
And B, as National Journal went out of its way to explain, this is the tip of the iceberg. This doesn't count the dinners and the tickets to sporting events and, you know, box seats at the Kennedy Center. This is just what they declared, which, you know, if you know lobbyists, you know they know their way around a spreadsheet and how to sort of shelter some of the money they both make and spend. So, yeah, tip of the iceberg. So,
amazing.
Just bad news to show you.
Yeah, indeed. This is another story I thought was fascinating. You know, the bad news is you're sick. The worst news is you're not you anymore.
I think this is so important, and it got a blip in the mainstream media this week. It's crazy. Somebody stole a laptop from the National Institutes of Health. And now a couple thousand patients are at risk for having their identities stolen. So on this laptop, they had 7 years' worth of sensitive information about 2,500 patients who were involved in a clinical trial about heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
Their medical records, their heart scans, their names, their social security number, like everything about these people. And so someone stole this laptop, and A, in violation of government policy, none of the information, of course, was encrypted like it was supposed to be.
Right.
And B, NIH found out about this a month ago, and they didn't tell anybody. They just sat on it until someone in the press found out about it. And their excuse was they didn't want to alarm anyone.
Well, right. Well, is there any evidence that this, computer got used in a way that this information was compromised, or did it just get sold to somebody who reformatted the hard drive and made a quick $100?
They don't know. They haven't had any indication that any identities have been stolen yet, but it sometimes can take a while for that to come forward. But it would have been nice for them to alert the people who were then at risk so they could take some precautions. And I also think it's striking because this is so not the first time this has happened. You know, this has happened. It happened with a very famous case with the Veterans Association, which basically put anybody who'd served in the military at risk. It happened with the Treasury Department. It happened with the Transportation Security Administration. It And the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, did a study this month and found that out of the 24 federal agencies they looked at least 19 had put American ID at risk of being stolen. And why I think this is important, and you know, yes, in and of itself, it's an interesting story, but the more the government pushes us to, quote-unquote, trust them when it comes to reading our emails or recording our phone calls or, you know, looking at our mail and that sort of thing, you have to remember there is a greater risk of that information not being protected.
Right. You and I are starting to sound like Barry Goldwater here, but it is true. The Constitution is there not to grant us rights, but to limit the powers of government. And particularly for this kind of reason, broadly speaking, that we, our right of privacy is actually a limit on the ability of the government to snoop, not a proclamation that we have a right. The rights were inherent. I mean, the rights are given, and it's really quite extraordinary some of the ways that these cons have been getting around this stuff. The White House, to move along here, the White House is fighting for their right to pollute, or at least for the right for big Republican campaign donors, presumably, to pollute.
Yeah. This, I mean, they're just shameless. The Federal Appeals Court last year found that the EPA had violated its own Clean Air Act when it allowed these big power plants to release more mercury into the atmosphere. And the federal court said, you can't do that. That's in violation of your own law. You must not allow these power plants to have all of these asterisks next to their names and put all this mercury out there. And so the White House is appealing that decision, and they're fighting as hard as they can for their right to allow these power plants to put more mercury into the atmosphere, which, A, is really bad for the planet, and B, mercury is one of those things that causes birth defects and really hurts, gives brain damage to little kids. So
right.
It's one of those.
And adults, too, for that matter.
Things.
I mean, it's not good for anybody.
Right.
It's not good for your pets. This was kind of a footnote, but I find this fascinating, and I didn't want to, you know, get through this segment without mentioning it, that in the state of Ohio, if we add up all of the McDonald's, all of the Burger Kings, all of the Wendy's combined, that's a hell of a lot of businesses. That's a hell of a lot of retail locations. I mean, you know, McDonald's, Burger King's, and Wendy's. And there is a type of business which, to the best of my knowledge, by and large, didn't even exist 30 years ago, that is now more populous. There are more of these businesses than the combined total in the state of Ohio of McDonald's, Burger King's, and Wendy's in the state of Ohio. And that type of business is?
These are these predatory payday lenders. These are these bad guys who basically go out there, and if you borrow against your paycheck, you basically write them a blank check, and they can charge up to 400% interest, or whatever they decide to come up with.
Oh, we've seen it documented here in Oregon of 800%.
Oh, yeah. And they prey on people who are already in financial, you know, disarray. And Ohio has been hit so hard by the housing crisis and by the current economic downturn. And these, it's just very indicative of what's going on with the economy. These things sprung up there like evil little mushrooms.
Do you think that the Grameen Bank is going to open a branch here? The micro lending folks in Bangladesh who give $25
right.
loans to poor people?
Well, that's, I mean, it's just, the
it's
average
almost time
person,
for
it. It really is. The average person who makes a, or who borrows $325 from one of these places ends up paying over $1,000 once the day is done.
That's the average?
That's the average.
Wow.
And
profitable business.
It's a very, they make a lot of money. And last year, they successfully said they really like to spring up around military bases and prey on these families who are left in economic hardship when their husbands or wives go overseas and to fight the war.
Right.
And, you know, Congress stepped in and said, okay, enough. We're putting a cap on the interest rate that these nasty places can charge people. And they did put a cap successfully last year at about 35%, which is still really high. But they're fighting. These companies are paying a lot of money to fight putting a cap on for average Americans.
More money for those lobbyists.
Exactly.
And finally, we are number 22. America's number 22.
We're number 22, according to Jane's Country Risk, in both prosperity and stability. Way to go, President Bush. Make us proud.
Amazing. Well, this is 30 years of Reaganism. Welcome to the disaster of 30 years of Reaganism. Christy Harvey, Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Thank you so much, Christy.
Thanks, Joel.
Great talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
When the paycheck just ain't stretching like it might have once before, 'cause good jobs are all gone, left you in some big box store. Between food and rent and medicine, seems the suit's frayed a little bit more. When the bosses cut that last corner, they walk out of those doors. When the truckers hauling sweatshop stuff won't stop there anymore. When the folks won't cross your pickets, 'cause their folks the same as yours. That is one big union.
Indeed. Welcome back. Hey, just a reminder to our listeners in Missoula, Montana in particular, we'll be doing the show live tomorrow from KMPT 930 in Missoula. And at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, Friday the 28th, I will be giving a talk on my new book, Cracking the Code, at the Holiday Inn Parkside at 200 South Patty in Missoula. It's free and open to the public. And we'll be signing copies of any of my books, actually. You know, bring the ones you have. There'll be a few for sale there. And our guests tomorrow will include Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer, Montana Senator John Tester, and, of course, Senator Bernie Sanders, our first hour brunch with Bernie. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, a great website. And, by the way, you can check out the growing archive of information from our trip to South Sudan and Darfur over at talkradionews.com. Most of the information links off the upper left-hand corner of the website, as I recall, last time I was there a day or so ago. Ellen, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. We're actually going to be working this weekend to get a lot more up on that website.
Oh, great.
The president today gave a speech in Dayton, Ohio at the Air Force Museum, and he gives a very rosy picture. He says that we have broken the grip of al-Qaeda in the capital, meaning Baghdad. We weakened the influence of Iranian-backed militias. He said they systematically dismantled al-Qaeda in the one of the provinces, in particular the Anbar province, and he said that in Anbar they have gotten from 18 attacks per day to less than one a week. Then he talks about how business has increased and going on, all about how reconstruction, how the Iraqis are now paying for their own forces a lot more, and basically said that, yes, 4,000 Americans had died, but they did so with honor, and they did so because they loved freedom.
Now, Ellen, was he standing on the deck of an aircraft carrier when he said all this? I mean, there's an eerie echo here.
When he said all of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this sounds like mission accomplished all over
again. Oh, yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying. Exactly. No, just at the aircraft museum.
Uh-huh.
He also has, it's interesting because the Pentagon, of course, has a very different view of it, because they know that the surge is a big problem, in terms of long term, and they're also having a lot more problems. But of course, none of them are going to speak on record about that, although there are some whispers certainly at the Pentagon. And also, today, several Democrats put out some comments on the president's speech. Steny Hoyer, who is the House Majority Leader, has said that the reality is that rockets are continuing to rain down on the Green Zone. He said that Iraq's second largest city, Basra, has basically fallen into chaos, violence, and bloodshed, and that car and suicide bombs are continuing to kill scores of innocent Iraqi. And then he talked about our number of wounded. So Steny Hoyer is certainly responding to the president's speech.
Well, thank God somebody is. I mean, that is, like I said, it's mission accomplished all over again. I mean, they blew up the pipeline in Basra today.
Their right.
Oil spiked at $107 a barrel. It's
exactly.
Incredible. What else is going on?
As you know, the president is going next week to NATO. There have been several discussions and briefing in Washington about NATO and whether Ukraine is going to join. The president is also going on to have a talk with Putin before he leaves office and before he becomes the prime minister. So the president will be traveling to Russia to discuss this, but Ukraine is certainly something that is top of their hit parade. Also, two competing economic speeches today, one of Obama that he gave in New York and one of Senator Clinton. She was in North Carolina talking about education, job training, and Pell Grants. And then they had dueling press conferences or press briefings on the phone today, both at exactly the same time, which was 1 o'clock Eastern. And she has accused him of, one, taking her ideas for the economy, not being very creative about it, not being a creative thinker. Then she said that Obama believes that voter participation in the democratic process is not in the best interest of America. And
what?
She said that the media was... I'm sorry?
Hillary Clinton actually said that Barack Obama believes that voter participation is not in the best interest of...
Well, her Wolfson and Singer, her press people said that, yes.
Holy cow.
I know. And then she said, her Wolfson and Singer said, that the stepped up, that he, because he doesn't have much on the economy, it is true that he has used the same figure as she does about the $30 billion of stimulus, and she sort of, with other Democrats, came out with it.
Yeah, well,
but
sometimes
then he said,
reality is reality, too. You know?
Right. And then he said, the two of them said that since he has nothing to offer really along that he has stepped up intense personal attacks on her, and the media was turning a blind eye. The other thing they said at the call is that tax returns, her tax returns will be out there in a week.
Wow. I you know, this kind of negative campaigning, I am just so concerned that this is going to harm her long term in any venue, in any regard. I mean, even as a senator, not to mention what it's doing to the party. Ellen Radner.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com. Ellen, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you.
Tomorrow we'll be live from KMPT, 9:30 in Missoula, Montana. And, of course, Bernie Sanders will be with us, Governor Brian Schweitzer, Senator John Tester. It's going to be a great time. And so come on back around. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.